Hi everyone, I'm Stephanie, a mom to a Mito fighter. On our podcast, Energy in Action, we talk all things Mito, and I'm glad you're here to learn and to be part of our community. Today we're speaking with a rare disease advocate and father, Steve Smith. I want him to tell you the story on how he became such a fierce fighter for rare disease patients, so I'm going to hold off on the lengthy introductions. But before we get started, we know that you are all listening to our show while you're doing other things. So having a notebook and a paper and a pen might not be convenient. Don't worry. You can find all of our information that we discussed today either in the podcast show notes or over at mitoaction.org. Hi, Steve. Thanks for joining us today on our podcast. Why don't you go ahead and tell our listeners more about how you became a rare disease advocate?
Thank you, Stephanie, for having me. I really appreciate being on your podcast. My advocacy really started when my three-year-old was diagnosed with a rare disorder. That was back in 1990, so it's been a long time, and things kind of accumulated. Like everybody who has a child with a complex rare disorder, the advocacy I did at first was to get things sorted out for him and our family and medically, and also adapting the situation in the community and with school eventually and so forth. But of course, immediately, I also began looking to see if what can be done medically. We had an excellent medical team, but I was also pretty quickly introduced to the world of clinical research. That's very common for rare disease advocates. And sometimes the motivation is when you're told there is no cure. And then you start to ask the questions as a newly diagnosed parent, okay, so what needs to be done to get a cure? And so after a few weeks, I was able to go to a conference, luckily, where a doctor stood up and presented a breakthrough in genetic medicine. He had discovered the gene in dogs for a related disease. And he showed pictures of slides and cells and scientific things that were over my head. And at the break, the doctors and the physicians, and the researchers who joined them, and the families were present, were socializing. And the doctors said to me, they said, this is going to be medicine. This is a really important presentation we just watched, but it will take about 10 years to get from his lab into patients. And there will be a whole clinical trials process. And so over the 10 years, I was learning more and more. And about 10 years later, there was a clinical trial for that disease, which is biochemically related to my son's disease. And by then, I was a whole decade later in being an advocate, and I realized all these different diseases are interrelated. There's science that has to be solved, which can apply when solved to lots of diseases, maybe at least a small group. You don't have to go one disease at a time. Then I also learned in that decade about the regulatory hurdles to rare disease drug development. And that's really what galvanized me when I realized we're making scientific progress, but the regulatory process was broken. And it was holding up rare disease drug development. And from our perspective as parents, that's just unacceptable. And it should be unacceptable to everybody. And so that's how I got started. It went from there, but I want to say it's a real eye-opener when you start paying attention that closely as you do when your child is diagnosed.
I agree. When we heard the same news about our son and, you know, no cure, no treatment, and you just sit back and you wonder, how is that possible in today's world? And then you kind of look behind the curtain, so to speak, and just see the chaos that ensues on getting a drug to market. And all I kept thinking is there has to be a better way. And again, I found the hurdles in the regulatory process. It just seemed like that process hadn't caught up with modern day thinking. And sometimes I think it still stalls out there. So how did you end up going to the Hill, and what initiatives did you help to pass?
That was about a decade later from the initial diagnosis, when I learned some details about how the regulatory process works and what the obstacles were. So I saw this as something which needed to be fixed, and something that I should raise my voice about, because in my career prior to this, I had been working in the software industry, setting up businesses and doing things for, you know, software companies worldwide, going all over, meeting with lots of companies that make and distribute and implement software. And those were usually process improvement software projects that these companies were all doing. So I was well steeped in what process improvement is. And when something's really complex and there are a lot of stakeholders and moving parts, there's a way to put projects in place to start making it better. And I've seen transformation happen. So I thought, oh, well, if I'm not going to raise my voice with that background and what I've learned about my son's disease, who's going to raise their voice? And of course, there were already patient advocates doing it, but this is my introduction to that world. So I gathered a lot of facts and I asked the FDA for a meeting in 1999, and they didn't give it to me. They said they were going to, but it never happened. So I contacted my members of Congress and I had the meeting within a day. I mean, we scheduled it within a day, if you're just a week or two later. But what I learned from that experience is several things that are really important and what has driven me ever since. Number one, the boss of the FDA is Congress. Congress sets the mandate under which the FDA is operating. The boss of Congress is us. We're citizens of the United States. And in other countries, it's the same. There are regulators, there is government that sets those policies. And if it's a democratic country, they can vote. And our door is also open in Congress to go visit, and we can email them and we can see them in our district or on the Hill. And what I learned from that is they're wide open to hearing from us what we'd like them to do, members of Congress. Then I also learned in that experience, when I had the meeting with the FDA, this was very interesting. I documented in advance what I wanted to meet them about. I had a multi-page typewritten agenda with explanations of my positions. And they brought the right people to the table. They went through the whole agenda with me, and they agreed with all of my points. And that was an eye-opener for me as well, my second eye-opener, I guess you could say. And in fact, I would summarize that whole document and that whole meeting as me saying to them, here are the 9 things you're doing wrong and the 6 things we want you to do. And I thought, you know, this is the truth. I've stated it in a way that is irrefutable, but I was a little concerned they would be annoyed. And they think, I'm stepping outside my boundaries because I'm not a professional in regulatory. I'm not a scientist. But that wasn't how they reacted. They reacted, they said, this is very important. They said, you are describing exactly what's wrong with drug development. And it's also important that you patients and families of patients raise your voice. So they did all 6 things I asked them to do, which included sending an official from the FDA to co-present with me to a scientific symposium, where the room was filled with, we had 100 scientists, researchers, physicians who specialize in specific rare diseases, and family members, some of the more leading advocates. And the FDA official laid it out. I asked her to tell them why you are holding up some of these trials. And then that triggered a dialogue with some of the physicians that had some research in their databases back home. And the FDA said, oh, I'd like to see that data. And the presentation of that data to that FDA official as a result of that meeting did move some FDA approvals forward. And so that was my other eye-opener, that if you get collaboration going across stakeholders, you can really make a difference. And none of these stakeholders, the FDA, the biotech company involved with that data, the scientific researchers, the parents, nobody is against this. Everybody wants to help the children. And I'll even tell you something neat to finish off that story. The FDA official that was sent to present with me, I could tell she was nervous facing this big audience full of parents and specialty researchers and specialty physicians, all of whom want them to hurry up. She was concerned, but it went very well. And she is the mother of a rare disease patient herself, the FDA official is. So it isn't like there's them versus us. And I think that's guided me the rest of my 2 decades or more as an advocate, is this is about collaboration. It's not about confrontation, unless for some reason you need to get a little bit of attention. But usually the fact that there are children involved gets the attention. Now, the hard part is the collaboration and the work. And the FDA is on our side, and they've worked hard in collaboration with us for a long time.
Wow, that is a very moving story. I had no idea that you presented 9 things you're doing wrong and 6 things I need you to fix. And they reacted to that in a positive way to make these changes. I've been in those meetings as a parent, and you just want to yell, hurry up, we don't have time, hurry up, we don't have time. And I'm so thankful that you were there to help sort of untangle the knot of processes and hurdles that are there in the system. So knowing what you know now, sort of behind the scenes on how how the process worked. How has this changed your view on our healthcare system, and what are some things some of our families can advocate for for themselves and for their children to not be so bogged down in the bureaucracy of things?
You mentioned time. Time is definitely of the essence. We're talking about progressive diseases. And once the disease progresses to a certain point and damages certain parts of a person, it's not retrievable in many cases. That's why we have that sense of urgency. And back then, when I had that meeting I just described, one of the complaints was that they were setting the regulatory process back continually to square one. For example, they would know that a biotechnology company was going to do a clinical trial. And that was then allowed by the FDA. So then the research was done, data was collected, and presented to the FDA. And the FDA would say back then, and did say, you've included biomarker evidence here to show that as the medicine is being taken, the experimental medicine, the presence of an unwanted macromolecule is declining in the system, which you are saying biotech is making the patients better, or is an indication that they're going to get better or not get as sick. And what the FDA said is, we don't agree with your use of that biomarker. So go back and do some more research. And so what I explained to the FDA, why that's wrong, even though there's something right in what they're doing, they're trying to keep everybody safe, because you could also misinterpret biomarker. The fundamental that was wrong, that any project manager can clearly see, you don't need to be a scientist, is that they waited until they got the data, and then they told the company that they didn't approve of that use of that biomarker. And by then, I don't know if it was 1, 2, or 3 years that had passed, but it was many months during which specific children are deteriorating in their health and they're going to die. And so that kind of lack of communication is inexcusable. It doesn't matter what the scientific explanation is, even though we have to remember the biomarker argument, which persists today in regulatory circles, is an important one because they're trying to keep people safe. So there's this tug of war in the healthcare system, in the regulatory process, in drug development, between safety and speed. And as parents, we want speed. Of course we want safety. We assume that these professionals will keep us safe. And then if they don't, then people start to sue them and so forth. So it's the tug of war is real. What I've learned, though, is now things can be different than they were back in the year 2000 by the time I had that meeting. And that is, we have modern science that's much more advanced. We have computing, which is much more advanced, to do things that humans trying to figure things out on a calculator couldn't have done. We have a lot more knowledge of the human genome. We have a lot more knowledge of lots of things in science, but also the collaboration is very sophisticated today. So we see the collaboration between the stakeholders I mentioned, patient advocates, regulators, biotech firms, researchers at universities or the NIH, and members of Congress too. That collaboration has become sophisticated. Instead of being like one parent at a time going to complain with an agenda and so forth, it's sophisticated. So we have all that. And so what I contend is we can have safety and speed. And we have seen an evolution of both the way drugs are developed and the regulatory officials' willingness to try to make the regulatory system work better for rare diseases too. But also we've seen the healthcare system, that's the delivery system. So we have drug development and delivery. Delivery is very important to all of us, that if we're not received well in a hospital, or the hospital professionals, healthcare professionals, don't understand our children's diseases, then things are going to go wrong. And it's hard for a healthcare professional. They can't know all the diseases and all the nuance. That's why this sophistication of collaboration is important, that families are increasingly part of the healthcare system. This is really something for newly diagnosed families too, to realize, use your voice. When you're in a hospital, use your voice. Hospital healthcare professionals who have been around the block, they appreciate that too. In the drug development process, use your voice. Let's try to make it better. And even when it's working fine from a regulatory perspective, because sometimes it does, there's a lot of improvement. We've got a lot of smart people working in the regulatory process that's really helped. But when it's going well, families can still get together and do things to help accelerate the drug development process, like help get natural history data collected severely lacking in rare diseases. A lack of natural history data is one of the things that holds up our children's trials. So there's a lot of things about, I think it boils down to the word collaboration. It's very important.
I agree. And that is something we talk about, I think, daily at MitoAction, is the lack of natural history data. And just we're 20 some years into this disease, and it's heartbreaking and mind-boggling to know that there's actually no database out there that can tell me how many people are affected and how they are affected. It just seems like with the advancement of technology, that should have already been done. But hopefully with people like you out there helping to get the message out on just how important that is and how impactful that data can be on moving research forward, we'll start to see some growth and acceptance of gathering that information. I appreciate your passion on that. Use your voice. I myself am a strong advocate, and I try to help other families get to that point to say it's okay to have a conversation with your medical team. You are part of the team. And just like we're the boss of Congress, I like to remind people you're kind of the boss of your medical team, and you can have a say and have a little bit of a dictation on what your hopeful outcomes are and how you would like to get there. I think that's really important to keep stressing, that we have to keep all the stakeholders, and parents and patients are part of that stakeholders, in a robust collaboration, or we'll just stall out again. So I read in your bio that you worked on the legislative efforts for the 21st Century Cures Act. How does that impact our rare disease patients? What in there was good for us?
Well, that's a great question. Rare disease advocates worked hard on 21st Century Cures in collaboration, and it was a fantastic turning point in legislative change for us. Kickoff of the effort, I believe, was 2014, and the bill was signed into law in 2016, the last act that President Obama signed during his last month in office. What's remarkable about it is, and was a sign of really excellent change, is the collaboration again. Both sides of the aisle in the House and the Senate worked on this. The House and the Senate had to collaborate together. And both sides of the aisle don't like to collaborate. Even back then, the country was very polarized, especially in things relating to healthcare policy. But the one Democrat and one Republican stepped forward and said, we're going to host 21st Century Cures as a process to get this legislation passed. And what it did for rare disease drug development, and the reason we worked so hard on it, is it brought a lot of that, fixed a lot of those nine things that were wrong that I had documented in the year 2000. So imagine my delight when I heard Congress introduce 21st Century Cures. I was there in the chamber when the House Energy and Commerce Committee kicked off what they called a listening process that was going to last months. They said, we're going to listen to all stakeholders. And they had a hearing like you see on television with people testifying. And I was sitting on the side watching. And the commissioner of the FDA, Margaret Hamburg, testified. And Janet Woodcock, high-level FDA official, then also testified. And people from university research and a number of others. There was a very experienced patient advocate at the table from Friends of Cancer Research. My favorite part of it was when the chairman kicked it off. And he said, the FDA regulatory process is in many ways the product of another era. In fact, he said the relic of another era. The officials testifying, including those FDA officials, agreed. They even used words like, yes, the process is broken. We agree. We need to fix the regulatory process, the FDA officials said. So again, I'm seeing it's not finger pointing, it's collaborating to fix. A lot of people in the room understood the process the FDA was using came from the early 60s after the thalidomide drug disaster, when we realized we don't have the regulatory control we need. So again, they're trying to keep us safe. Now we're in a new 21st century. It's time to fix it. What we got from that, besides acknowledgement that these things are not necessary, that we've been crying out for as individual parents, is an improvement to something called breakthrough therapy designation, which came originally a few years earlier in one of the legislative initiatives, which a lot of us know, the Prescription Drug User Fee Act. It's renewed every 5 years. Like 21st Century Cures, it's a place for advocates and industry and lawmakers to pour their desires to get legislation passed. And breakthrough therapy designation was passed in 2012, but it was strengthened in 21st Century Cures. The reason that is very similar to my chief complaint from the year 2000 is it gives people, companies, I mean, drug developers, if they have a breakthrough therapy, they give the evidence, early evidence, to the FDA and say, we would like you to designate this as a breakthrough therapy that we're trying to develop. And if they do, and they often do now, they give a company more interaction with them and earlier review dates of their data to make sure that clinical trial keeps proceeding with efficiency. That's exactly the problem that I had talked about in the year 2000. I said, you're not listening to the biotech companies. You're waiting, letting everybody wait months while they're doing this research. Then they bring it to you, and then you go back and say, get the broom of the Wicked Witch of the West, get out of here now and come back. That's what I was complaining about. I said, you can't do that. Stop doing that. And then this is many years later now, but eventually enough had recognized that problem that was being fixed. Breakthrough therapy designation in the 21st Century Cures initial hearing before the law even passed, I believe it was Janet Woodcock. I watched her. She said, that is actually working. She was trying to tell the members of the committee, making these legislative changes works. We got it in 2012, she said. And now what we're finding to our delight is many companies are signing up for breakthrough therapy designation and sending us their evidence that they've got a breakthrough therapy in their lab. And we are giving them in return faster review dates and, more importantly, from my perspective, an interactive channel. So if I'm a biotech company and somebody walks out of the lab to the president and says, I have data I didn't know we were going to get, but we got much more positive data in from the patients taking the drug, then the company has a way now to contact the FDA and say, we have some data we didn't anticipate. And the FDA will let them come and or send the data and review it in an earlier time frame than originally planned. So now it's based on progress. It's based on what's really happening in the world, as if everybody's trying to help our kids get a treatment or a cure instead of, well, the rules say I don't have to talk to you until those days are over. 21st Century Cures strengthen that. It also required, like PDUFA, it strengthened something called biomarker guidance, where the use of a surrogate biomarker, instead of just being something that the FDA says, oh, by the way, I don't agree with your biomarker. You can't do that. Go make more data. Now they have to give them a response and I call it biomarker guidance. They say, if you're going to use this biomarker, our guidance to you is don't forget to give us this kind of clinical data to back it up, that kind of natural history data. I don't know all the ways, but it's a way of having an interaction around that biomarker and the proposed data before too many months pass.
That is excellent.
Patient-centric drug development was also in both of those. And that's been important for patient voices going to the FDA and describing their diseases.
All good points. I truly am enamored with how dictated they were, or not enamored, but just kind of dumbstruck is the best way to say it, is how they were just so stuck to the guidelines and basically a calendar was ruling the system versus somebody raising their hand and saying, we've got data to share. We think this needs to be expedited. And that those conversations had to take place in an actual hearing for legislative bodies to say, yeah, I guess we can make some improvements on this process. And it's working beautifully. We speak with biotech companies all the time at MitoAction and are so encouraged at what they're doing to try to find treatments for so many of our patients. And I know I've said this to you before, but when my son was first diagnosed and up until about 2016, I said, I think hope is a four-letter word. I didn't have hope. And last few years, I feel very hopeful. And it's empowering to be part of the process, even if my part is letter writing and speaking to congressional leaders about why this is important, and my son participating in the NIH. That's all I can do. Right? I can't be passive. So I thank you for really setting up success for the rare disease families with the 21st Century Cures Act, because that is a very powerful piece of legislation that went through.
It is. And you just really made a very important point, Stephanie. As a mom, you know, it's easy to become so involved in trying to just do the medical stuff right and try to make life as normal as possible. That alone can be overwhelming. And the legislative or the regulatory process and those kinds of things may not be for everybody. There are lots of moving parts. It's complex. I would say to patient advocates who are coming on board and want to do some advocacy, that kind of advocacy works. In that kind of a very complex environment where we feel so small because we're just one family with one child, and we're talking to the United States government or to the big biotech industry, it works. And if the way we know it works is we can look back and see where it was, where it is, and how these changes got made. And that's what I've just been doing in this interview, with saying, I did this and other people did this. And because lots of people are doing it, these changes were made, exactly the changes we wanted. So those letters you're writing today and those phone calls you make and those people you're coaching, you'll be able to look back and see the progress. But it might be a few years and down the road that you're looking back. It's what we do today that makes the progress for a few years. That's all we can do.
That is valid. It's definitely worth taking a look back occasionally to give yourself that oomph to keep moving forward, to see that you have made progress. Because sometimes, as we all know, the wheels of Congress go slowly, but they do move.
I also would like to say, you know, the FDA has really done a lot of great stuff, and it's documented too, by the way. There's a great white paper on their increasingly flexible approach to rare disease trials, keeping the scientific aspects in place. It has to be science-driven, the safety aspects in place, but using more modern ways because the science and other technology has changed. They've really made some progress. Now, they still wear this FDA, the regulator hat, and we wear the patient hat. So there's some differences. But we also have this wonderful biopharmaceutical drug development industry, one that the general public tends not to understand. They get treated very roughly by politicians, especially at election times, when if you say things into a microphone, crowds will cheer. If you complain about drug prices, crowds will cheer, you'll get votes. And sometimes the change to improve those things is important. And legislators might be seeming to work at cross purposes. I think our priority today, though, is let's not let the progress of rare disease change, the legislative change we've gotten, which has made the difference and saved the lives, let's not let that get thrown out like the baby with the bathwater, as Congress today is trying to lower drug prices. And they're talking about some of the ways that the pharmaceutical industry makes money. And some of them are talking about that like that's the enemy. But as a rare disease parent, I would say, I want companies to make a profit off of my son's disease. Because just a few decades ago, there was no money in rare disease drug development and nobody would do it. University researchers would do it with their small, tiny little grants. But they do it, they make the breakthrough, but there's no company to pick it up and make it into spend the millions on a trial. So at the beginning of 1980, we had around, I believe, roughly 70 FDA-approved treatments for rare diseases. Today, because of the legislation changes, we have 700 approved treatments for rare diseases.
That's incredible.
Now, that's not enough. You know, the number of rare diseases is 7,000. So we have treatments for about a tenth. But at the beginning of the 80s, we had hardly any at all. So that's all about, you have to have a market. There have to be people who will invest. If Congress takes away their ability to make a profit by making laws too difficult for rare diseases, investors will just put their money someplace else. They'll put them in the big common diseases, which already has a lot of money. You know, people have 401ks and funds that are supposed to grow. They're not all looking at the nuance of the rare disease stuff that we are looking at. But we have to hope Congress can, even these new members of Congress who haven't been around the block in this area, that they learn, they take the trouble to look at what they're doing before they make it too broad of a change.
Right. Yeah, we can't have a broad sweep. So I would like you to just briefly touch on your passion with newborn screening and how that affects your family and your journey in rare disease, and how can our listeners support this effort? Because I'm relatively new in the newborn screening world, and I'm absolutely all in on this. I cannot talk enough about how important it is to maintain our newborn screening and to expand it. So I'd like you to speak on that as well, because you've been part of newborn screening since the start.
So it's one of the, right now, very important patient advocacy actions that everybody can take, every citizen, every person, looking up what the details are. And you can do that on the Every Life Foundation for Rare Diseases website. The Every Life Foundation for Rare Diseases is one of the organizations for rare diseases that is advocating for this. And people with common genetic diseases also need to be concerned. What newborn screening is, of course, is when a baby's born, they do a heel prick, and then they check that blood to see for diseases. And it happens every time a baby's born. But what diseases are being checked for is what's at issue here. There's a list of them. And as we get a new FDA approved drug, after all this effort we've been talking about in this interview, we sometimes then have a treatment for a disease that never had one. But that's not going to be on the newborn screening list automatically. Newborns are not going to be screened to see if they have it. Yet these are progressive diseases that are going to start harming some newborns immediately, and every day and every week and every year, worse, and make it worse and worse. So what we're saying is we need to get those diseases, when their drugs are approved, onto the list. Now, here's why we have to advocate. To get it onto the what's called the RUSP, or the Recommended Uniform Screening Panel, that's something at the federal level, it takes some years of getting members of Congress to understand it and to say, yeah, we'll do that. Then you have to go state by state. States have to get to decide whether they're going to adopt for their newborn screening in their hospitals what's on the federal list. In translation, we get a drug approved after many years of hard work, and finally there's a drug, and it's going to be at least roughly 8 years before it gets onto the your state's newborn screening panel. And so through the efforts of advocates going to the Hill to talk about this and sending emails, you can send an email to your member of Congress in about a minute and a half and say, please support newborn screening. That's all you have to do. But if you want to learn the details, you find out why, you can explain that and teach your member of Congress. And there is legislation right now to reauthorize Access to Newborn Screening Act. We call it Access to Newborn Screening Act, because everybody doesn't have access. So what the Every Life Foundation for Rare Diseases does, that's everylifefoundation.org, by the way, they have a boot camp for advocates. Anybody who wants to learn how to talk to their legislator about newborn screening can sign up, and it's virtual. You can do it online, Newborn Screening Boot Camp. And it gives you the ABCs of it. So, you know, in language we can all use. But, you know, when you have an issue you want to talk to a member of Congress about, there's two things that are simple to understand. Number one, it makes a difference if a citizen tells a member of Congress what they'd like them to do. They do take note of that. They do add them up. The staff members will say, hey, 4,000 families called this month about this issue. And the legislator is often grateful. Oh, good. I want to know what my constituents want. But it takes about a minute and a half. You can go to house.gov and you can key in your zip code, and it's going to give you your house rep for your district. You can go to senate.gov and key in your zip code. It gives you your two senators. And then right there on their websites, you go click and it opens their website. There's a template. You key in what you want to say. So I'm just trying to paint a picture that it's really easy to influence your members of Congress. And you need a lot of people doing it. It's not like they're going to do what you want because you said it. But if you don't say anything, things won't change. The story I want to conclude with is my granddaughter was born with a rare disease in April of this year. So she's going on 6 months old. And she was diagnosed with a rare disease while she was still in the hospital. And the parents and the baby girl had to stay in the hospital for a month. And now she's home and things are fine. But she has a rare disease that's totally unrelated to my son's rare disease. But she's born so many years after my son that they detected her disease. So they knew within 1 month, beyond a shadow of a doubt, what she has, through something called rapid genome sequencing. So it was not on the newborn screening panel, but they saw symptoms. So they did a whole genome sequencing, and they did a portion of it called rapid genome sequencing. But this is also something that we want everybody to have access to, not just people with, like me, with excellent insurance at one of the best hospitals in the world. That's Northwestern Medicine. It's possible scientifically. This is also something advocates are talking to legislators about. Like, let's have that also be available to people who are not as well insured, who are on Medicaid, poor families, families in underserved areas, but also not just children at newborn time, but people on Medicare. They don't necessarily have whole genome sequencing covered by Medicare. So there's a never-ending list of things that advocates can do to give people access to the science and the medicine that can make us better. But that's where it's important to use your voice and to use your collective voice as you do it, Mito Action.
Yep. And we always like to say that, especially like with that, with whole genome sequencing that can be done in the expedited panels, being proactive and finding something is so much more effective than being reactionary, Reactionary is just costly on everybody's resources. And if we can be proactive and catch these kids and these babies as soon as we can, the progression, everything slows way down because now you have a plan. And if we're constantly with so many of our patients who are 20, 30 years into getting a diagnosis, the amount of resources, time, energy, money, just pure brain cells being spent on just throwing things at the wall to see what's going to stick, that could all be eliminated if we could just start at the genome, you know, start there and start looking and understanding what we're already learning throughout our genetics discoveries.
You're right. We're talking about a massive historic change for the better. When focusing on the genome, you're talking about the diagnostic odyssey so many families go through where we just don't know what's wrong. We know something's wrong. And I know in the mitochondrial disease area, there are diseases like that. Like the one that my granddaughter was just diagnosed with, it's not a mitochondrial disease, but same thing, that the families don't know what the person has. And because they don't know, then sometimes the wrong treatments are being done. Lots of extra doctor visits that turn out not to have maybe been helpful, but certainly are draining the family of their resources, both emotional and financial. And sometimes treatments are given that are damaging as well and not the right ones. That's why diagnosis is so important. And that's why genome sequencing is something that we need to give everybody access to from the day of birth.
I agree. One closing note, one of the genetic labs that we work with a lot with MitoAction, they made such a powerful statement to me. They said, even though sometimes we can identify and give a name and give a diagnosis to the family, it still doesn't give them the golden ticket to get into a treatment or a cure or a path of more known information. But at least they have that time now where they have they can take that energy from searching for a diagnosis and put that energy to something else. And it's so freeing for the families to finally have a name to something. And even though you don't really have a treatment or a cure for it, at least you have a name and you feel validated. And that's so important because so many rare disease families just feel completely, I don't know how to say it. They feel like people think that they're making up what's happening when they're not. And so to be able to get that validation is just a key thing for so many families.
That's right. Families feel lost and it's all consuming. And some of that does go away when you have a diagnosis. And then at least you know where you are, whether there's a treatment, and you're not going to be given damaging treatments that were not called for. There's a lot of reasons to get diagnosed, even if there's no approved medicine yet.
Well, thank you, Steve, for being on our show today. I've just enjoyed our conversations, and I look forward to staying connected with you. And you've really empowered me today to get back out there and get some more conversations going with my legislative bodies here in Minnesota. So thank you.
Well, it's wonderful talking to you, Stephanie, and I really admire MitoAction and all the families from the mitochondrial disease organizations and individuals that I've met who show up to advocate on the Hill and who are have their battles with their diseases, but also rise up to see what they can do to stop it. So thank you for having me. It's really been an honor to meet you and talk to you.
Thank you. Well, that wraps up another episode of Energy in Action for this week. I hope you found all of the information from Steve as fascinating as I did. His story is a true testament to what can happen with parent perseverance. You can learn more about newborn screenings on the Every Life Foundation website. They have an easy-to-use Newborn Screening Action Center tab right on their front page. Also, if there is something you want to know about, learn more about, just let me know. I want to bring you content that is meaningful and helpful. You can reach me at info@mitoaction.org. Remember to give us that 5-star rating on your listening app. It really does help us out. This is your host, Stephanie. Until next week.